Well, good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau. And Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. I'll have Torin Wilkerson and Mark Wheeler, Ulrichsen and Mark Wheeler here in a moment or two to talk to us about a study on the effectiveness of Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And then some folks will drop in from Pavitt Fitness to talk about their health seminar Thursday. Steve Kosis will be here to talk about this evening's planetarium event. And we'll hear from some folks from the Association for Education of Young Children about a program they're putting on tonight. The members are Thursday night, I guess it is. And then members of the Juneau School District will come in to fill us in on the latest in the school district. Weather today, numerous snow showers, rain showers, little or no new snow accumulation, highs around 37, southeast winds, 10 miles per hour, becoming light and variable.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Over the weekend in South Dakota, Lakota horseback riders and non-Native riders protested a plan to reduce veteran services. As Jim Kent reports, opponents feel the plan would impact veterans living in rural areas, especially on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
It's been more than 2 months since the Black Hills Veterans Administration office suggested relocating most of its health care services in Hot Springs to Rapid City, 60 miles north. Joe Morissette is director of the Oglala Sioux Tribe's homeless veteran shelter. Morissette says closing down the Hot Springs facility would make an already difficult situation worse.
A lot of our elderly live on monthly income. And they have a heck of a time getting here anyway, you know. So if we were to close this down and get it sent to Rapid, we'd put a lot of burden on our older people and in general, everybody.
Morissette attended one of the many meetings VA Area Director Steve DeStacio has had since December of last year. Although DeStacio assures all veterans, including the Lakota, that the proposal isn't a done deal, Morissette says he's not comforted by the director's words.
I think sometimes there's a little, you know, something behind the scene kind of thing there.
The VA is also proposing to outsource veterans care to non-VA area health providers and Indian Health Services. Morissette calls the plan a kick in the thigh to all veterans. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
A Northern California tribe is working with the federal government to reestablish its traditional ceremonial grounds, flooded by a reservoir 30 years ago. Jacob Resnick has more.
In 1982, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dammed Dry Creek in northern Sonoma County to create Lake Sonoma, a 2,700-acre reservoir for flood control, drinking water, and recreation. Native Americans of the Pomo tribe resisted at the time because the lake covered up traditional village sites, but now a project is underway to give the tribe closer access to its flooded lands.
The tribe came to us several years ago, and they were interested in the government land and what opportunities there were to use it.
That's Richard Stratford, an Army Corps archaeologist based in San Francisco. He says the Pomo once lived throughout the Dry Creek watershed.
There was a permanent site along Dry Creek, you know, which are now underwater. But those, you know, those served as permanent villages, which then would be, you know, the inhabitants would move out during the different seasons, you know, hunting, fishing, and botanical collecting.
Dry Creek was also a significant source of sedge grass, which the tribe used to craft its watertight baskets.
The sedge beds, they were more of a spiritual event for the weavers, the basket weavers. You know, I think they would see these plants were being offered, you know, to them.
A plan now under public review would allow the Army Corps of Engineers to lease 24 acres near the dam to the Dry Creek Ranch area band of Pomo Indians. Site would allow the rancheria and associated Pomo tribes to build a village and a food prep area for tribal and public events. The Dry Creek Rancheria declined to comment, pointing to an environmental study open for public review through March 15th. Stratford says there's been few public comments so far, and construction could begin as early as this summer. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Sonoma County, California.
During this week in 1973, Oglala Lakota and American Indian Movement members occupied the Wounded Knee site on the Pine Ridge Reservation. The occupiers wanted to draw attention to the mistreatment of Native Americans by the U.S. government. The siege lasted more than 2 months. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use Pick, Click, Give when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3. You're in tune with KTOO News. Quick update on that weather forecast. As a matter of fact, it's an updated forecast from the Juneau Forecast Office, just about 15 minutes old. We have numerous snow showers forecast and rain showers for the rest of today. Little or no new snow accumulation, though, because of the mixture of rain and snow. Highs around 37. Southeast winds 10 miles per hour. Those will become light and variable later in the day. Tonight, we're looking at mostly cloudy, isolated snow showers this evening. Lows around 29, light winds. Wednesdays, mostly cloudy, highs around 36. Southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. That condition continues Wednesday night. Low will go down to about 29, same winds. And then Thursday, cloudy, chance of rain, slight chance of snow. Highs around 36 Thursday. Southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. So the weather is just basically what you're looking at out the window right now for the next couple of days. And I have guests in the studio with me who are going to tell us about a recent study that was completed that talks about the effectiveness of the National Big Brothers and Big Sisters program. Torin Ulrichsen, who is the program director here in Juneau of the program, and Mark Wheeler, who is the associate director for program implementation and evaluation with the national organization, are joining me. Torin, tell me about our local the findings about the study that affect Juneau.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So I think Mark will be able to definitely talk a lot more than me about this study, but we were a pilot agency for this program called Enhanced School-Based Mentoring Model, and we were the pilots, and we started off in the Anchorage office, and then we took a lot of the pieces and brought them here to Juneau, and we are still using the majority of those pieces to help better our school-based mentoring program so we can have more positive and lasting outcomes with the youth in our program.
So this is big brothers and sisters coming into the schools, actually? Or
correct, no, yes. Okay. So we've been in the schools for almost over a decade now, and we have volunteers that go and meet with the little for 1 hour a week at the school, and we encourage not only for them to meet throughout the school year, but also to keep meeting throughout the summer and also on the winter break so that they can continue to have that relationship and continue to make positive impacts.
Mark, what were the findings of the study?
Well, basically, we were trying to learn from our previous studies, and I really think Big Brothers Big Sisters is to be commended for how much they've been a learning organization. And starting out in the 1990s, we subjected ourselves to what's called a randomized control trial. It's like the highest level of research evidence where you tell one kid you're going to get a big brother, and another one is randomly assigned not to get one.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the difference in impacts. And we did that in the 1990s and found out that, yes, Big Brothers, Big Sisters in our community program, which is all we had back then, where that's the program most people are familiar with, yeah, those kids are doing better than kids without a Big Brother or Big Sister. So we took that study, and then we did another one in the 2000s, 2007, on our school-based program, did the same thing and subjected ourselves to this you know, really strict lens of research evidence, which a lot of organizations don't do because they're afraid to not find anything, frankly.
How big are the samples in these studies?
There are about 1,000 kids in each one, and, you know, 10 or 12 agencies around the country were participated in both those studies. But we took the latest study of the school-based program where we found that we had impacts on the first year of a school-based match, and then we followed those matches into the second year, and a lot of those matches weren't meeting anymore. And so the average length of the relationship was about 5 months. And when we evaluated it that second year, we saw a lot of those great impacts fall off. Mm-hmm. So we said, what can we do to improve this program and improve the outcomes we're having for kids? So we came up with this enhanced school-based model. And the Alaska agency was one of the agencies. There were four agencies around the country that helped design this thing. It wasn't just that they piloted it. helped design this model, and then they were part of the group that tested this to see, well, if we enhance the school-based program, does it result in better impacts for the kids than this kind of standard program? And we found that, yes, we did. We were able to increase the length of those matches. So those matches that were in this enhanced program stayed open through that next school year. They're more likely to stay open. And we know that the longer matches have a bigger impact.
So you've used the term impact several times now. What can you define an impact?
Yeah, we study mentoring is kind of unique in that it affects the whole child. So when we look at mentoring, we see that we affect academic outcomes, we affect risky behavior outcomes, we affect parental relationships, peer relationships. There's a wide range of outcomes that we're affecting. And so when you look at mentoring as a whole, the effect sizes, which is some scientific term that kind of is a standard way of looking at the impact, they're modest, but they happen on these wide range of outcomes. So it's not as focused as some other interventions for kids, which may have a bigger effect size, but we affect the whole child and help each child reach their full potential. So when we look at these studies, we look at a number of things, but it's cool to see that we're affecting so many parts of a kid's life.
So, Lauren, when you were involved in the design of the study, were you actually working with VBS here in Juneau at the time that was designed?
I was. I've been with the agency for 4 years.
How did you go about doing the design work that Mark talked about?
I was with the agency, but I wasn't quite on the level of helping to design. But I think what some of the things, like you mentioned, that we looked at was how to make these matches longer. So we really looked at what was happening that wasn't allowing these matches to go into the second year and kind of changing things to allow those things to happen. So some of the things that we changed was that we're not going to be able to enroll in our school-based program fifth graders. We can, of course, enroll them in our community-based program, but we want to make sure to match just those kids ages K through fourth grade who will be able to then at least be matched for over 1 year in the school-based program. And also, for our volunteers, we make sure to that they can at least commit to 1 year, not just the school year, but to a full calendar year, so they can go into that following school year. And then also not enrolling high school seniors. So we do have a lot of high school volunteers, which is a great pool. But unfortunately, those seniors, if they leave to go to college or leave for jobs, sometimes their life changes a little bit too much where they're able to meet that commitment. So we like to be able to first and foremost make sure that both the youth and the volunteer can make at least over 1 year commitment.
When you talked about high school seniors, are you talking about high school seniors who are bigs or littles?
Bigs.
Ah, okay.
So thank you, yes, for that clarification.
So a little is defined by some age?
Yes. So it's in the school-based program, they start off in K through fourth grade. If they are matched and continue to meet past fourth grade, they can meet in the middle school, but typically we don't usually start matches in the middle school since it is a little bit harder to find that consistent time. And then in the community-based program, it's actually 6 years old to 17 years old, so it's a little bit broader of a spectrum.
What are the criteria for a child to be selected as a little?
They just have to want one, and the parent has to be on board ultimately. Other than age, we don't really have too many other restrictions as long as they know they're not going to be moving out of town anytime soon. So any child who wants a volunteer, we will try our best to get them a volunteer.
And then I understand this is a more complex question, but what are the qualifications or what do you look for in a big?
That is a good question. They have to be over 18 for the community-based program, and in the school-based program, they at least have to be in high school or older. And we do a variety of different background checks and references, and we just look for someone who would be able to make a positive impact. It doesn't need to be anyone who has experience. We're happy to do training, and we're happy to be able to work with a volunteer to give them the training they need to feel comfortable to be a mentor.
If someone felt called to participate in this program, how would they make contact with you?
They can look us up on our website, which is bbbsak.org, or they can call 586-3350.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that if they just Googled something like Big Brothers Big Sisters Juneau or something like that,
yep,
that you'd
absolutely
pop up
yeah
close to the
gotta
top
love
of the
Google
list.
Just Google us and you'll be able to find us.
Yeah, it's so difficult. Radio announcers are really glad to hear of Google because it makes it so much easier than doing all that .com/.org kind of thing on the air. Anyway, Mark, will there be additional follow-up to the study now that you've looked at the results and like that?
Yeah, that's part of my job is to help implement these new initiatives across our nationwide network. We're serving 200,000 kids around the country and less than 400 agencies. So right now, since we have these positive results, we're going to try to encourage our whole network to adopt this enhanced model. And I'll be helping agencies around the country figure out how to do this, how to institute these things, like Torn has mentioned, and additional things with school partnerships to help put this model in place so we can improve our outcomes for kids across the country. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, this last month we just released our first ever youth outcomes report, and kind of the same outcomes I talked about previously. We've made a commitment to tracking our results for every child we serve. So every child that comes into the program takes a pre-test and a post-test every year, and we're tracking those results. And it's really neat to see that they mirror the results that we've found in our randomized controlled trials. So we are seeing a positive impact on kids around the country in those areas I talked about previously.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for updating us on this study and letting us know how the program's doing in general.
Thanks very much.
We have a success.
Thanks for having us.
Não há quem diga que o caminho certo, rumo novo a ser seguido. O mundo é o mesmo a céu aberto, mapas, atalhos, pontos, rios, estados, mundos. Se está na flor a poesia, no arco-íris a cor da vida, na chuva terna e fria, de colorida, estão a paz e a harmonia. Mudei minha vida num só momento, acreditando no paraíso e vendo que só o sentimento faz o deserto ar. Só com o amor do povo, vida bonita desde paraíso.
Music by Mulligan there. Oh. Okay, the CBJ Parks and Recreation Department is holding a public design workshop. They'll be this evening at 7 p.m. It's in the Terry Miller Legislative Office Buildings. It's in the gymnasium. That's an old school up on 6th Street downtown. The purpose of these meetings is to develop a new master plan for the Capitol Park, Capitol School Park. That's the what used to be a parking lot on the end of the building, but now it's been converted into a couple of playground spaces. Chris Myrtle, the principal landscape architect at Corvus Design, will be conducting the meetings, and they're really encouraging the public to attend because the idea is to design a park that responds to the public's needs. If you want information on the hearing, it's at 364-3388, but just show up at 7 o'clock this evening if you have an interest in Capitol's school park. So in the studio with me right now are Corey and Ellen Pavitt, and they're doing a series of seminars out at the Pavitt Fitness Recreation Center on things like weight loss and exercise and all that sort of stuff. So welcome to the show. We talked to you last week, Corey, I think, or a week ago, 2 weeks ago,
A couple of weeks ago.
And this is a continuation of the same series. Can you move just a little closer to that mic so you don't sound like you're out in the hallway? There you go. Our mics are very close talking. So what's coming up?
Well, we have a seminar series that we run. It's free to the public, first of all, and anyone who's a teenager or older is welcome to attend. And every Thursday night, we offer a free seminar on a health or fitness-related topic. Runs all winter long, and we especially wanted to tell about what's coming up for our seminar this Thursday night, as well as let listeners know the lineup for some great seminars we've got coming up throughout the month of March.
Okay, so what's coming up Thursday?
Well, this Thursday night, we have Patricia White. And she's done this before, and she's going to do it again, back by popular demand, does a seminar on meditation, and it's for beginners or returnees. And it's really important that everyone knows it's a non-religious meditation. The focus is on relaxation, addressing stress, enhancing your sense of well-being in life. And her seminars are always very well received by people that come to them. She does a fabulous job. She's been studying under her own meditation teacher for 20 years and teaching meditation for more than 6 years at this point.
Let me speak to the doctor for a moment. Meditation has to do with, well, much of it comes from religious and yogic backgrounds, but it has to do with the production of alpha waves. Am I correct?
Well, probably actually Ellen would be.
Ellen? Okay.
Ellen might be better at this. But certainly I think all major religions have used meditation, but there's now been a real move to make it non-religious, and the Harvard Medical School and a bunch of other places are really pushing it for just general well-being. And that's whether you're, regardless of what your focal point is, meditation is all about focusing the mind on one single thought or one single breath or what have you. And if you could do it in a religious context or you can do it in a totally non-religious context as Pat White is doing here.
The Dalai Lama has said that, as a matter of fact, he held a seminar, I think, about 2007 or 2008 that involved a lot of neurosurgeons.
I was there.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Oh, and this is talking about plasticity of the brain.
It was phenomenal. Yeah, I went to the seminar. He gets a bunch of scientists up on the stage, and this year's seminar that year was on meditation. And he did. He had neurosurgeons up there. He had, it was really amazing, psychiatrists, Catholic priests. And they all spoke about the power of meditation to help people in a huge variety of ways.
And as I understand it, the science of neuropsychology essentially said that the brain stopped growing when we became adults, that it didn't develop new pathways.
They used to think that. I don't think that anymore.
This was the beginning, really, of a major shift in that kind of thinking.
That, too. The neuroplasticity is the term, and they spoke about that as well. One of the physicians spoke about how he uses meditation with his patients who have psoriasis, and that it reduces the incidence of
psoriasis
outbreak.
Is a skin disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a cardiac physician spoke about how he uses meditation with people who have had heart attacks, and a psychiatrist talked about how she uses it to treat depression.
And chronic pain also.
Yeah, you were in Dharamsala when the...
No, this was the seminar I went to was in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
But he has a lot of seminars.
The one I'd read about was conducted in Dharamsala.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Pat White, again now, for Thursday evening, where does her meditation teaching go?
As far as...
I mean, what does she do?
Oh, well, I have actually studied under Pat, and... She's in this seminar in particular, she will start with the basics. She'll give you ideas about how to sit or lie, whatever works best for you, how to focus your mind. Especially at the beginning, people are encouraged to focus on their breath, and that's what Patricia did when I learned from her. And she talks about how, you know, do you need to do it every day, once a week, once a month? What are some of the roadblocks? How to make it really become a part of your life?
That's probably the single most difficult component of trying to put meditation into the Western lifestyle.
Any practitioner.
Are there any tips?
Come to the seminar.
We're not going to give it all away for free.
Well, it is free.
You are
free.
Free
Thursday night.
I think there's probably as many tips as there are people struggling with trying to make a new habit. I've struggled with it for many, been involved with it for many, many years and struggled the entire time. What I've finally found works for me is that I don't leave the bedroom until I've done it. And that's
in the morning.
In the morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
some days I just still leave the house.
No. So sometimes you get to work at 11, 12.
Exactly.
Yes.
But yeah, if I
now you know why.
I think it works better when you haven't been up as long and you haven't had as much time to get your brain going. But also, I've just found that once I get going, I'm just so much less likely to go and be willing to sit. But if I just get out of bed, go to the bathroom, have a drink of water, and then sit down and set the timer, I'm have pretty good compliance.
Well, not to give too much away here, but the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi said that we should meditate 20 minutes twice a day. Is that the prescription that you would recommend?
I don't feel like I'm the expert. My goal, as in any exercise program, is do what you can do. Be realistic.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be an excellent routine for someone to follow. I think most beginners would probably be better off once a day for 10 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and as their ability to sit increases, then they would want to increase it.
And so to come to Pat's seminar, it's Thursday night at?
Mm-hmm. At Pavitt Health and Fitness.
At what time?
At 6:30.
At 6:30, okay, and should last about?
About an hour.
About an hour, mm-hmm. Okay, and you don't need to bring anything?
Nothing. No, we have everything you'll need there, some chairs, some sitting
pads. You might want to wear loose, comfortable clothes.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if you already have a pillow that you like to sit on when you meditate, feel free to bring it.
Okay, so 7 o'clock Thursday night.
No, 6:30.
6:30 mm-hmm. Thursday night, and you were going to say something?
Oh, I was going to say that just... really would like to encourage people who have had absolutely no experience whatsoever with meditation not to be embarrassed and not to feel overwhelmed by this. Please come and see how simple it is and what a positive impact it could have on your life.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. And you have other seminars coming up then?
I just wanted to run down really quick. March 8th, Kanani Ray, one of our personal trainers, will do weightlifting for women.
Women only.
Women only, yes. March 15th, another of our personal trainers, Kathy Washburn, will be speaking on working out with arthritis. And March 22nd, Kanani and her husband Sean will be speaking about Olympic lifting. And then grand finale for the month, Corey's going to talk about weight loss through effective exercise.
Oh, so a set of... What did I count?
Five
seminars?
Five
seminars? Five more?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay.
But they're all free, and they all begin at 6:30 at Pavitt Health and Fitness.
And if you need more, of course, you can't all remember this. So each week we'll have the current one coming up on our website at gopavitt.com.
Okay. So gopavitt.com. Nice, nice, easy website to remember. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So 6:30 Thursday night. Mm-hmm. Patricia White.
Patricia White.
Patricia White, mm-hmm. doing a seminar on meditation.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Now it happened that the Norse god Odin had two ravens that perched on his shoulders. Every day he would send them into the world, and upon their return, they would tell him everything they had seen and heard. Storyteller John Stansfield and his wife Carol live in Larkspur, Colorado, far from the land of Odin. In the traditional summer camp song, the Stansfields sing, "It's not a raven, but a little bird that comes to sharpen its beak on a mythic mountain."
In the land of Odin, there stands a mountain, 10,000 miles in the air. From age to age, that mountain measures 10,000 miles square. Once every million years, a little bird comes winging, sharpens its beak, and swiftly disappears. And when that mountain it wears away, then to eternity shall be one single day.
What might that little bird be for you? What bird do you imagine flying through eternity? For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
KTOO News, it's just about 3:30. Pat Moore, your host for the Juno Afternoon Show today. I have a couple of guests with me in the studio here. Lauren Brooks and Nikki Morris are here to tell us about an open house that's being put on by the Association for the Education of Young Children. Hi.
Hi.
So when is this open house?
It's tomorrow evening from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at our office, which is in the Juno Empire building on the second floor.
Okay, and this is Lauren speaking.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and Lauren, why are you holding an open house?
We're holding an open house because we're hoping to get more providers, child care providers in Juno to be licensed or approved so that they can be easily found by parents who are looking for quality child care. And so we just kind of want to invite people who maybe are caring for kids already but haven't thought about licensing or haven't really made it into a business to come and learn more about what that would look like and our office and our supports and also meet child care licensing and the child care assistance office as well.
So, Nikki, is the association a private organization or is it a state or how?
It's a nonprofit organization. It's an affiliate to the National Association for the Education of Young Children. And we have several grant programs, and one is the Child Care Food Program, which helps pay for the foods that providers are serving to kids, and also the Resource and Referral Program that helps pay for training for child care providers, as well as the Child Care Referral Program, which helps parents find child care.
So there's not a requirement for someone to be licensed, but evidently this is a program that you're that you'd like to see many more licensed child care providers, is that right?
Well, if a person is caring for fewer than four children, they don't have to be licensed.
Okay.
If they're caring for more than four, the state does require licensure. And to become licensed, a provider has to pass a background check as well as minimum health and safety standards in the home. And we work with a lot of parents who are looking for quality and that, you know, that minimum health and safety standard to know that their children are in a safe environment.
So you actually make recommendations for people who are looking for, or do you?
Well, not a recommendation per se. What we make are referrals. So we collect the information from the providers and kind of act as a clearinghouse to parents, then giving that information along with tools about how to find quality care. And then it's really up to the parent to see if that provider will be a good fit for them.
Lauren, can everyone take advantage of your service?
Yes, absolutely. Anyone can call us at any time. I mean, obviously we're only there Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. But that's me.
We're not giving out home numbers
right
here.
Got it. But I provide child care referrals as part of my position. And so someone says, you know, I have a one-year-old and I need part-time care and I'd prefer it to be in the Valley. And then I can search and see what the openings are and generate a list with descriptions of various things. And then they can go and visit them. And so 789-1231 is my direct line. And we're also online. But it's really nice because if you were to just look up all of the licensed providers in Juno and then start calling them down the list, most of them wouldn't have any openings and you wouldn't really know much about them based on that. So it's a good service.
And then if someone is thinking of becoming a licensed healthcare provider, how would they reach you to get more information besides coming to the open house?
They can call our main number. It's 789-1235.
Okay. So those who are interested in licensing. So the open house is at what time?
It's at 5 p.m.
5 p.m. And, again, where is the AEYC office?
We're in the second floor of the Juno Empire, second floor north.
Okay.
And there's going to be snacks and door prizes and networking, and it's just to kind of find out more. You don't have to have a plan or anything.
Okay, good. And you're primarily looking here for people who are trying to get licensed as providers.
Yes, although really anybody who has any interest in AEYC service can come by at any time or give us a call.
Okay, so a chance to maybe even get referrals and that sort of
yeah,
thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, thank you very much for dropping by. It sounds like a really valuable new resource resource for the community. I hope you get a good bunch showing up for the thing.
Great, thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 28th of February, 2012.
It's the birthday of the man who said, even on the most exalted throne in the world, we are only sitting on our own rear end. Michel de Montaigne, born near Bordeaux, 1533, a learned man who retired from public life on his 38th birthday to begin a life of study, mainly to examine his own life in a series of essays. His best friend had died, and Montaigne missed their conversations, so his essays were a kind of conversation between himself and his friend. He wrote, "Don't discuss yourself, for you are bound to lose. If you belittle yourself, you are believed. If you praise yourself, you are disbelieved. Not being able to govern events, I govern myself. The greatest thing in the world is to know how to belong to oneself. I care not so much what I am to others as what I am to myself." It's the birthday of Colum McCann, Dublin, 1965, son of an editor at the Irish Press, middle-class boy, happy childhood, went to work at the Irish Press, and then at 19, after a summer in New York City, he fell in love with America and returned 2 years later. Went up to Cape Cod, bought a typewriter, spent a summer trying to write profound things, biked across the country for a year and a half, 12,000 miles through 40 states, went to college in Texas, met Alison Hawke, who became his wife, and in 2009, his sixth novel, Let the Great World Spin, was a great success, set in the 70s, weaving together the stories of a dozen New York characters, including prostitutes, a young radical Irish monk, a Park Avenue mother in mourning for her son killed in Vietnam, won the National Book Award for fiction that year. Colum McCann, who said, "I believe in the democracy of storytelling. I love the fact that our stories can cross all sorts of borders and boundaries. I don't know of a greater privilege than being allowed to tell a story or to listen to a story. They're the only thing we have that can trump life itself." Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dobbins, Sun Gazers. My stepdaughter is 3, and we have some games we play when she gets back from daycare and I've finished my work for the day. In one game, while I try to find her, she climbs on a chair and closes her eyes because with her eyes shut, she thinks I can't see her, but must prowl around calling her name, which I do, to amuse her. Then, tiptoeing back, I give her a slight poke, which pleases her as proof of my cleverness that I've found her secret place in all that dark. The mind, too, I think, has many eyes, which we open one by one, as if the world's too bright, as waking at night and turning on the lamp, I keep an eye squinched shut and feel unprepared to face the glare. My stepdaughter, with eyes shut, feels safe as I circle her dark hiding place. To look around her means perceiving danger, yet soon she will come to look into the light. Death, too, is a kind of light, a larger sun we spend our lives learning to look into, as if by seeing we might defeat our end, like those Indian holy men who live by staring at the sun, trying to discover what lies past common sight, and so die blind. Sun Gazers, a poem by Stephen Dobbins from Cemetery Nights, published by Penguin Books, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Sponsored by Constant Contact, celebrating the launch of Social Campaigns, a brand new social media marketing tool. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Well, it's about 20 minutes to 4, and we have as a guest in the studio a man who is going to tell us about the origins of the universe at the planetarium. Steve.
Well, thanks, Pat. I'm quite flattered. So today's Tuesday, February 28th, and tomorrow's the leap day, so this makes it an interesting year. And tonight, 6:30 p.m. at Marie Drake Planetarium, we're going to have a show called Big Bang for Beginners, and it's free and for all ages.
So this is about the event that probably is the reason that everything's moving away from us at such high speed.
Well, the actual event, the Big Bang, is dated now 13.7 billion years ago. And if we call that time zero, everything that is right now was crunched into zero volume, infinite temperature, infinite density, and infinite curvature.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and
the Big Bang.
All of a sudden.
And then all of a sudden there was not a bang, but an expansion. And an expansion from zero volume. So the Big Bang would be better to call it a small expansion.
Ah, that eventually grew up and became a larger expansion now.
Became where we are right now.
Yeah, how
so
long?
Everything we see right now and experience right now at the time of the Big Bang was all one, was all connected, was in a point, the smallest point mathematically possible, zero volume.
I think a poet has said that we're all stardust or something like that. So,
well, that was had to do with the stardust from supernova explosions,
yeah.
Which explains the heavier elements.
Right.
So the Big Bang was a point in time, an actual point in time, time zero.
Uh-huh. And now we continue to expand from the initial expansion. How long does that go on?
Well, it was thought at one time that the expansion would slow down and that things would go in reverse and we'd have what we call a big crunch. But current observational data is showing that the expansion of space is accelerating. So it's not, the expansion is not going to end currently with the standard model. It's going to go on forever, and eventually, a Google years from now, 10 to the 100th power, we will only see our local neighborhood. Everything else in the universe will not be visible to us. It's called the heat death.
Oh, I'm having trouble getting my mind around this. How do you find the room for infinite expansion?
Well, it isn't. What it is expanding is space itself.
Okay.
So in a sense, every place in the universe is the center of expansion because it's space itself that's expanding. It isn't an object that's expanding. It's space that's expanding. And also, when we talk about something like the Big Bang, we're talking about the mathematics that models it. So when we talk about it in prose, in a language like English, we're translating from the mathematics. So some of the original idea is lost.
Steve, how will you show this? When you do your talk Thursday night, how are you going to, or tonight? Thursday night.
No, tonight. Tuesday,
tonight.
February 28th, 6:30 p.m.
Tonight. When you do your talk tonight, how are you going to visually illustrate what you're talking about?
Well, mathematics to a lot of people is an abstract concept. So I'm going to take the most abstract of arts, music, and also visual multimedia, and try to explain it that way. And my poor attempt at English, I'll add that on. So I will be, stimulating some of the senses to explain about the Big Bang, but ultimately, to truly understand the Big Bang, you have to have some background in mathematics. And not just algebra, differential geometry, topology, group theory, abstract algebra.
It probably helps to have read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time to get it.
And he also, his new book, A Briefer History of Time.
Yeah,
has come out.
So, I see you have a copy of it with you. Is this your
A Briefer History of Time?
Your cheat notes for tonight?
Yes, true.
So, what time do people need to show up for the show?
Well, the show starts at 6:30 p.m.
Okay.
Tonight, and it's free.
And it's in the planetarium.
It's in the planetarium, Marie Drake Planetarium downtown.
Okay, and for maybe our two listeners who don't know where the Marie Drake Planetarium actually physically is, how do you get there?
Well, it's between the Marie Drake School and the swimming pool, and the entrance is right next to the artificial turf playing field that's surrounded by that 12-foot-high fence.
Oh, okay. So park in the high school parking lot?
Well, I don't know about parking. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say about parking.
I probably
there.
Can't do that.
Yeah.
But anyway, 6:30 tonight, the talk is on the Big Bang, and it's sort of a guide for beginners. So that we can
yes, and let me just add that before the Big Bang, we're going to do our usual, the stars tonight using the Spitz A4P projector.
Good. Okay, so the planetarium is going live tonight with the Big Bang, so tune in and see what that finds out for you. Okay, thank you very much for coming down and telling us.
Thank you, Pat, for having me.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
Together, these sisters are making a couple of pitchers of lemonade and other drinks for church volunteers. Olivia and Michaela go to Change Point, a large non-denominational congregation in Anchorage. Every few Sundays, you can find them here in the break room once the day's first service is underway. These teens volunteer to help the other volunteers. They're setting up the food they've prepared ahead for the day. It smells delicious.
Yeah, we made it. It's potato and sausage casserole and tortilla and chicken soup, and then for dessert, we have honey graham bars. Well, it's just fun to cook, first of all, but we just wanted to help out, and yeah, we just wanted to. Well, we just like to serve, and we just thought it was needed, so we just wanted to try it out.
Ada Brown is the girl's mother. She says the idea to take a turn preparing the food came from her, but pretty soon her daughters took over, and they're the ones who make sure the job gets done.
I work in the office, and I just heard that there had been a need. You know, there is the constant need of the volunteers on Sunday needing something to eat. They're here all day. They volunteer from early morning till way late, probably about 2:33. So there was a need for them to have lunches served. They go ahead and do the grocery shopping and purchase the food and make up the recipes. This morning they woke up at 6 a.m. to get all this done. So
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
That's how it goes.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
This is KTOO News. Here it's about 13 minutes before 4 o'clock, and I have in the studio with me David Lindrum, who's here to talk to us about the Science Fair program at JDHS. Hi, David.
Well, it's not going to be at JDHS this year.
No, it's not.
No, it's at Thunder Mountain this year.
Oh, so the whole thing's moved over.
This whole thing has moved over, new venue, new players. A lot of the same adult players are there, of course, but the kids are all new.
Yeah.
And focusing again on leading the young people of Juneau out the door, up to the big science world.
Now this is a regional science fair.
It is, and which means they come from Skagway and Haines. They come from Sitka. There's, I believe there's somebody coming from Wrangell this year.
Okay, and those who come in here and are in this science fair then can go on to science fairs at other venues. Is that
they can. They go to our statewide, to the national one, and then there's a world one. And there are kids from Juneau who've made it to the Stockholm competition and done quite well.
Really? One of the things that I've been impressed with, I've gone to the last, I think, 4 years, science fair award ceremonies, and I've also tried to get into the science fairs to look through the exhibits. Our students, I played in science fairs when I was in high school back in the 60s, and our students seem to be much better coached in the scientific method.
Well, look at our community.
Yeah.
Look what we have here. Not only do we have some world-class science instructors in the high schools, which really, I mean, we have been so lucky over the years to have had the science instruction we've had. But in our community, there are all these scientific mentors. I mean, there are professional scientists of almost every grade, who almost every discipline, who make themselves available to these kids. There's a tremendous amount of information passes.
Yeah.
And someone like NOAA has it as the part of their model, that every student will not be doing their own project off to the side that they take some time for, but they get swept into the on-site research going on there and get to work alongside professional scientists and get to participate there.
Do you know, are we kind of unique in that? In other words, do other communities have that level of intensity of mentoring?
Well, there are pretty scientific concentrated communities in the country. I imagine if you lived in New Mexico, you might find something like that.
Because of the astronomy.
Right.
Yeah.
And I imagine that if you lived in Silicon Valley, you might find something like that, too.
I notice our science fairs are fairly fish-heavy.
Fish and water.
A lot of oceanic mm-hmm. studies and things.
A lot of water quality goes on here, and a lot of snow deal goes on here, and also there's a lot of evolutionary kind of work, you know, not so much the single cell to multi cell kind of evolution, but the landscape evolution. What happens as the glacier retreats and the world gets a chance to respond to it?
When is the science fair open to the public?
Not this weekend, but the next weekend.
Next weekend.
Friday evening and Saturday in the afternoon. So Friday evening from 5 to 7 o'clock is the viewing time for the adults. At that time, they'll have the project set up, but the students won't be there. But the next day, they'll have their judging in the morning. And then from noon to 2 in the afternoon is a viewing time for the adults, for the families, the community, to come and walk around, and the students will be there with their projects. And part of their program, of course, is that they do the research, they collect the data, they make their conclusions, but then they present their data in a coherent form. And that's just as valuable. You know, it doesn't do any good to know something if you can't tell somebody about it. And the prizes are, you know, phenomenal.
So, David, that's March 9th and 10th.
9th and 10th.
And then the prize ceremony is...
It's the evening of the 10th.
Evening of the 10th.
And that ceremony, as you know, is pretty exciting.
Will that be out at the university?
It will be once again.
In the
same venue
as
been before.
Okay.
In the downstairs library.
Right, okay.
And it's really an inspirational event there.
It really is. Plus the fact that there are some really... there's a wide range of prizes that are given, not just from, like, in the case of the science fairs that I was involved in, the big givers were the Air Force and the Army, because military research in the 60s was very large on encouraging young students to do science. But now they come from such a wide variety of organizations.
They do, and there's two levels. There's the national award givers, and those will be like the Army and Navy, but it'll also be like the Office of Technology and the Public Health.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be ones from NOAA. NOAA is always a tremendous supporter there. And then the Union of Fish Biologists and the Genetic Biologists and all the kinds of regular scientific associations you would expect to participate are there. But there's also all kinds of community organizations that participate here, too. And that's something that's really, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Amateur Radio Club.
Yeah, you mentioned that because I'm involved with them, I think. But anyway, we're a very small component of what I see happening at the awards ceremony.
Awards ceremony, really, there's the national stuff, and that's pretty exciting. But I think that seeing the local organizations come and give their awards is every bit as exciting, watching that.
The other thing that has impressed me every year I've been involved with this is if you every once in a while you look around at the students that you know and you think, you know, this is the future of America, and you kind of have a rolling eyes moment. But when you see the kids and what they can do, when you walk through the science fair and you see these exhibits that show that this kid in high school, a junior, and he's 15, 16 years old, has taken literally science in his hands and worked it, made the process work at his hands or her hands.
Even if that student does not go on to win the Nobel Prize or anything else, they're a player.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll
yeah.
never not be a player. I know that my son did the science fair as a mandatory requirement when he was a freshman in high school. And he was not a scientific kind of kid. He has the ability, but he just didn't care about it that much. But that learning experience will never vanish. He'll have that stuff forever.
Yeah.
And he will, as he does now, dissect problems according to kind of the scientific method and make some theories and make some guesses and try out various methods. And you can see it going on in his life today, many years later.
So we're a week away. Most of the students are where in their preparation for the...
Oh, frantically polishing the last little bits of their presentations or dying of stage fright. Because, you know, of course, they are going to have to talk not just to the people that casually come by, but to this cadre of judges who come sweeping along. And they're all, you know, pretty insightful. And they're not just looking at did you figure it out, you know, because in some cases they couldn't figure it out. And in some cases the experiment didn't work. And many of the experiments that people try to do, say, using a botany at this time of year, you know, it's really hard to grow things in the winter in Juneau. And then at least half of them die. you know, but the scientific process has a space for that. You figure out what kind of knowledge you got from that and how to move on next.
David, what's your role in the science fair?
I'm a booster. I'm an enthusiast.
Okay.
I'm a convert. That's what you might call me. I'm a convert. You know, I'm perhaps a little bit of an apostle, but I'm really a proselytizer.
Uh-huh. So
I'm every year I have something else to do, and most years it's been my wife that does it. This year she's out of town and couldn't take up this part, so I'm doing the publicity, public relations for it.
Okay. And how, there's obviously besides the kids themselves that are involved in the projects, there's obviously a big structure of folks who are behind the stage, setting up the fair and making it all happen. Who are those folks?
Well, most of them absolute volunteers. There's a cadre of people who make the core. There's Lawrence Schaffler, who's the fair director. There's Bonita Nelson, who's in charge of the judging. There's Ron Heinz, who's pretty much in charge of the scientific arrangements, making sure that the projects actually, as they come in, have a scientific basis and they can figure out how to do it. The local science instructors in the high school, Ms. Walu, and the science instructors from the Juno Douglas High School. John Smith is not running the program this year.
Huh?
He's been the spark plug, and
yeah.
It is due to him, I'm sure,
yeah.
That there is such an event here. Even making it into a regional fair so they could be nationally competitive was at his feet. But he's going to be involved with it. We'll see him at the event and at the award ceremony, too.
Mm-hmm.
But from then on, it's people like me, enthusiasts. Like you would expect in any kind of community-based organization. And there's still need for more volunteers.
That was what I was going to ask.
We need hospitality people to support the judges. We, for the first time in years, have all the judges in hand right now.
Huh.
This has been always been the difficult part, is getting enough judges. And there's a meeting tomorrow night at 6 o'clock in the Thunder Mountain High School in the science room in the Purple Corridor. Room, I believe it's 116. And any interested adults that would like to come, or our youth that would like to come and volunteer, are encouraged to come. We'll be glad to see you and help you, and you will help us.
Okay, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, did you say?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock in the Purple
Wing, which is how the new high school is arranged.
Yeah.
And if you haven't had the opportunity to go into the new high school, this is a good chance for it, too. It's nice.
Yeah, it is. It's a beautiful facility.
And the gymnasium that they'll be working in is a quantum leap from the Marie Drake Gymnasium. The Marie Drake Gymnasium has been the home of the science fair for a long time. Everybody's very familiar and very comfortable there. It'll be a new venue.
And the science fair itself is on the 9th and the 10th?
9th and the 10th.
At TMHS. Dave, thank you so much for keeping us appraised of this really wonderful component of our
community. If anybody has trouble remembering it, they're welcome to get in touch with me.
You bet. How would they do that?
Use my cell phone.
Okay.
321-4149.
Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pat. Goodbye.
On tomorrow's Juno Afternoon, Amanda Compton is hosting, and she'll be talking to Pete Early, who is a mental health advocate brought to Juno by NAMI. Friday's Fireside Chat with Friends of Admiralty Island, she'll feature that. Meg Mackey will be here to talk about her new album release and the latest at Eagle Crest, a weekly feature on Juno Afternoon. KTOO is broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, you can tune to K276AF. We're on 103.1 there. If you're driving through Lemon and Slitzer Creek, or if you live there, you can get a better signal than the downtown signal on 101.7, listening to K269AO. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can tune KTOO on K210AS. It's on 89.9 megahertz. We're also on GCI Cable Channel 871. KRNN is on Digital Channel 872. And KXLL is on 873. And you can listen to our online stream at www.ktoo.org.
Who has que eu nem sei contar. São coisas lindas que eu tenho pra te dar. Bem de mansinho, a brisa me diz, é impossível ser feliz sozinho. Da primeira vez era a cidade, da segunda o cais, a eternidade. Agora